Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Bio 241. It's May 3rd. I believe I got all my recorders working and projectors are working. Okay, I'm going to turn somebody's lights down, so be careful walking around. Did we have to turn all the lights off in here last time? Maybe we'll try today. Raise your hand if you can't see the screens because it's too dim. Let me know. All right, so I got a couple comments. Let's look at the schedule right here because I think I have my schedule wrong. And for some reason, I thought we were having a test today, but I'm glad we didn't have it today. We are having a test May 8th, which is Tuesday. Okay, so there's a, and that test is going to cover chapters 12 and 13, not 14 that we see on the schedule right here. All right, so because we haven't finished up 14 yet. Let's see, what else do I want to say about the test coming up? Okay, it comes after the drop date. The drop date is this weekend sometime. When is May 6th? That looks like Sunday. Okay, I think I can drop people on Sunday. I'm not so sure you can drop after Saturday. So too bad about that test, but it's just the way it goes, the way I had it scheduled. Okay, there was a question regarding this test in terms of exam figures. And it had to do with the cardiac cycle figure, which commonly we call a Wiggers diagram. And so let's just go to exam study guides in Blackboard. And if you look under exam 4 right here, study guides by chapter, all right, I see chapter 12 and 13, which is nice. And then here is that cardiac cycle figure that's in your lab manual. Now I've modified it just a little bit. All right, and then here is the key for it. So I give you the key and the figure, because I know it's a little bit complicated. It'd be really nice if you could figure it out all by yourself. But what? So let's take a look at this. So I'm just going to right-click. Let's open it in a new window. So here it is. If I go like this, we can almost see it. How about if I go Control-Plus? It gets a little bit bigger, easier for you to say. Okay, so I modified it a little bit by changing the label of this first item in the column over here. All right, so it was pretty confusing the way it was labeled. So AV and semilunar, what does AV stand for? Atrioventricular valves, which are different than semilunar valves. All right, that's an important correction. And then on the diagram, make sure that this right here, you don't see that as a number one, that's an L. Okay, that's an L, the letter L right here on the diagram. And what else did I include? I also included P and Q for end systolic volume and end diastolic volume. So make sure you know which one is which. And you can use these numbers, end systolic and end diastolic volume, to calculate what? Stroke volume. Yeah, exactly. Just subtract those two numbers and you get stroke volume. Let me slide down. There's another modification that I made. Okay, on the diagram in your lab book, the time axis started right here. And it just was kind of a bracket, right, which had a zero underneath it when I first looked at that time scale. So it kind of confused me. I go, well, why is zero right in the middle of this thing? And that's really not what it was signifying. It was just signifying a bracket, and that's a letter O. So that letter O corresponds to something over here in this column, right? So that's a letter. So I extended this to make it a time axis, so zero starts right here, and then here's 200 milliseconds, right, then 400 milliseconds, 600, 800 milliseconds, or tenths of a second. So that's the other modification I made for this thing. So this will be on the exam on Tuesday. So know when the AV valves close and open. All right, so just remember that this is a very nice plot of four physiologic parameters. The first plot versus time is pressure in a number of different parts of the heart, two different parts of the heart, atrial pressure versus ventricular pressure, and then here is aortic. The sign-in sheet. I had one ready to bring down. I'm glad you started it. Okay, and then the next plot is of the volume of the left ventricle. So this is ventricular volume, and then we have electrical events. This is the ECG versus time, and then the fourth graph we have over here are heart sounds, and you can see where the heart sounds relate to opening and closing a valve, which relates to pressure differences between different chambers of the heart and the aorta. All right, so if you're really confused on this, then maybe see me during office hours. Well, for sure see me during office hours on Tuesday. And I don't know if I can do anything else to help you guys with that. I will see if I can put something as a video in Blackboard for you to look at. That would be cool. Okay, so what I wanted to show you for sure is that it's in Blackboard, both the key and the corrected exam figure, right, which comes from your lab book. And I haven't seen a Wiggers diagram that's exactly 100% correct, but the one in your lab book is the best figure that I've been able to see so far. All right, so does anybody have any questions on the Wiggers diagram? That I don't think I want to take too much time to talk about it right now. Or the first part of chapter 14, which is cardiac output, which is what we're going to look at now. Okay, so we talked about cardiac output already last time a little bit. Maybe I have to click out. Oh, very good. All right, so cardiac output is equal to your heart rate times the stroke volume. Right, so cardiac output is directly related to stroke volume of the heart and the heart rate. And remember, stroke volume is just the amount of blood that's pumped out of the heart every time it beats. Right, and so that is just end diastolic volume minus end systolic volume. That tells you how much blood is being pumped out of the heart. So that if the stroke volume of the heart increases, what happens to cardiac output? It increases. And if heart rate increases, what happens to cardiac output? It increases as well. You should have an intuitive sense of how that is happening, right? Because stroke volume and heart rate are both directly related to cardiac output. And then there's here just a little random fact that we put on this slide. Okay. All right, so the heart can be regulated in two different ways. It can be regulated by its rate, which is chronotropy, or it can be regulated in terms of its force of contraction. And force of contraction and the rate of contraction are two different things. Rate is chronotropy, force of contraction is inotropy. Okay, and I think I talked about this slide last time. Both the sympathetic and parasympathetic nerve fibers can modify, can modify the heart rate, okay, and so they can modify the chronotropy of the heart. Right, so both sympathetic and parasympathetic can affect chronotropy. And the way it does that is because both of those nerves go to the SA node. And what's another common name for SA node? It's a pacemaker of the heart. And here we see an action potential from the heart. And the first thing you should be able to recognize is what kind of tissue from the heart is this action potential coming from? Is it coming from a nodal tissue or from a contractile tissue in the heart? Yeah, nodal tissue, right? So this is not from a contractile muscle, but it's from a nodal muscle inside the heart. And here we can see under normal conditions, the pacemaker potential, the spontaneous depolarization from resting membrane potential. So these cells are at resting membrane potential only for a very short period of time. And then channels open up so that they start to depolarize. And the slope right here is relatively shallow. Okay, so it takes a little while for these nodal cells to reach threshold, which then causes an action potential, and then it repolarizes. All right, so this is the normal heart rate under control conditions. Okay, but if we release norepinephrine on the heart, especially the SA node, look what happens to the slope of this pacemaker potential. Right, and here it says pacemaker potential is in this color right here, which is what? Purple. Green. I don't know. What color is that? Red. Okay, this red color right here is the pacemaker potential. All right, so notice here under sympathetic stimulation, the slope of this pacemaker potential right here is very steep, so it takes a lot less time to reach threshold compared to control conditions. All right, and then after repolarization, the pacemaker potential slope is very steep. So once again, the heart is stimulated into contracting very quickly, and the third heartbeat happens, right, very quickly as well. All right, so the slope of the pacemaker potential under sympathetic stimulation is very steep. So threshold is reached quickly, so you have a relatively high heartbeat as a result of that. Under parasympathetic stimulation, right, acetylcholine is released from the endings of the parasympathetic neurons, And that closes, right, sodium channels, or it opens potassium channels. And if we open a potassium channel, is that an excitatory signal or inhibitory? That is inhibitory. So that that decreases the slope of the pacemaker potential, so it takes longer to reach threshold, and therefore the heart rate is slowed down when acetylcholine is applied to the SA node. Okay, so we see the dual innervation, dual control at the SA node for either speeding up the heart or slowing the heart down. And remember, it's always a mixture of these two signals, so there's a balance going on between sympathetic stimulation and parasympathetic stimulation that precisely controls your heart rate as a result. Okay, so that's a pretty important exam figure for this chapter. Okay, regulation of inotropy. What the heck is that? What is inotropy? It's not heart rate, it is? Yeah, it's force of contraction, right, or strength of contraction. All right, and just like chronotropy is regulated by the cardioregulatory center in the medulla, so is inotropy on the heart, right? And the cardioregulatory center is in the medulla, and it can send out sympathetic impulses via sympathetic nerves to the atria and the ventricles as well. And it can increase the strength of contraction of the atria and the ventricles. But notice there's something missing on this slide. How many divisions are there to the autonomic nervous system? There are two, sympathetic and parasympathetic. And how many do you see on this slide? There's only one. There's only sympathetic outflow, right? Parasympathetic outflow does not go to the ventricles. It only goes to the SA node and maybe to the AV node, but not to the ventricles. So the parasympathetic nervous system can have no effect on ventricular contraction. Only sympathetic outflow has an effect on inotropy of the ventricles, which is kind of funny. All right, so here we have the two nervous systems, sympathetic and parasympathetic. We have various locations inside the heart, like the SA node. What's another name for SA node? Pacemaker of the heart. So this controls what, inotropy or chronotropy of the heart? Chronotropy of the heart. And we see that both sympathetic and parasympathetic nerves go to the SA node, so both can affect heart rate or chronotropy. And sympathetic increases heart rate, and parasympathetic decreases heart rate. So they are antagonistic to each other. At the AV node, we have both sympathetic and parasympathetic. Sympathetic increases the conduction rate through the AV node, while the parasympathetic decreases conduction through the AV node, right, which then slows the heart rate down. Now let's look at the atrial muscle, not nodal fibers like we saw here at the SA node and AV node, but the contractile fibers of the heart, the contractile fibers of the atrium and the ventricle. What nervous system goes to the contractile fibers of the heart? Sympathetic only, not parasympathetic. And remember, the contractile fibers of the myocardium produce the force of contraction, not the nodal fibers, so it's only sympathetic innervation can affect inotropy on the heart, not the parasympathetic nervous system. And in this case, it is both excitatory on the atria and ventricle, so it increases the force of contraction. All right, so stroke volume. As a matter of fact, I'm going to make... Did we look at that figure already? No, we're going to look at it a little bit later on in the class. Sorry. Okay. All right, so stroke volume is determined by three variables on the heart. Some of these will be intuitive, some won't be so intuitive till a couple slides later on down in the lecture. The first variable is end-diastolic volume, which is what? The volume of blood in the ventricles at the end of diastole. And what's happening to the ventricles during diastole? Wow, I need another screen to put that Wiggers diagram up, because you see a plot of volume of the ventricles versus systole and diastole on that Wiggers diagram. So what's happening to the volume of the ventricle during diastole? Is it staying the same, decreasing, or increasing? It's increasing, right? Because during diastole, the heart's relaxed, blood is flowing into the ventricle, or maybe the atria is pumping blood into the ventricles, that will increase the volume. All right, and so the volume of the ventricle increases during diastole. So another way of thinking about that is the ventricle is stretching. And we looked at length-tension relationship in skeletal muscle. And we saw that if a sarcomere is very short when it starts to contract, it produces a very weak contraction because the sarcomere can't, or the myofilaments can't slide over each other any longer to bring the Z discs any closer together because the sarcomere is as short as it can be already. And so when you start to stretch a skeletal muscle, the force of contraction that it can produce increases, and it increases as you start to stretch it. The same thing happens for the heart. As it fills up with blood, the sarcomeres stretch a little bit, there's more optimal overlap of the actin and myosin filaments, and the force of contraction of the heart increases as the ventricle starts to stretch. And that's due to what? End-diastolic volume right here. Stretches the ventricle out. Total peripheral resistance also affects stroke volume, right? As the resistance to blood flow through arteries increases, right, then the blood flow through these arteries decreases if the resistance increases. So it's harder for the heart to pump blood into arteries if there's a lot of resistance to flow in them. All right, so that's sort of intuitive. And then the last thing over here is myocardial contractility. That's just the strength of ventricular contraction as influenced maybe by the sympathetic nervous system. Okay, so all of these things will increase or decrease stroke volume. All right, the end-diastolic volume, remember that's the big volume. That's when the volume of the heart is large. Sometimes we call that the preload on the heart prior to contraction. Right, and stroke volume is directly proportional or directly related to preload and contractility. So as end-diastolic volume increases, what happens to stroke volume in a normal heart if it's directly related? It increases, right? So as the heart fills with more blood, the contraction of the heart gets stronger and it can pump more blood, which is a really handy feature. We call that an intrinsic feature of the heart, very important feature of the heart. All right, so strength of contractions varies directly with end-diastolic volume, which is what we call the preload on the heart. The resistance to blood flow out of the heart, which we call total peripheral resistance, we call that the afterload. That impedes the injection from the ventricle. All right, so that will decrease stroke volume. And then I have just another random term right here called the ejection fraction. And maybe you could think of this as like the hematocrit. Hematocrit is just the percentage of red blood cells in whole blood. It tells you the percentage of red blood cells that you have in a volume of blood. But the ejection fraction is the amount of blood that's pumped out of the heart compared to how much blood was in the heart to begin with before contraction started. So it gives you an efficiency of how strongly the heart is contracting. Okay, we call that the ejection fraction. It's determined by measuring the stroke volume and then dividing it by the end-diastolic volume. And it's normally around 60% in the normal heart. But when you start to go into heart failure or if you have valve disease, the heart begins to get weaker, this number starts to decline to 55%, 50%, 45%. And knowing that number, then it's useful for surgeons to time various kinds of procedures that somebody might wish to have on the heart. Like, for instance, if I present you with a proposition right now in class, how would you like to have a brand new aortic valve today? What would be your thought? Okay, I'll give it to you for free. I'll give you a free aortic valve. Would you want to take it? You probably would think, well, gee whiz, you got to open up my heart, my chest, and put that brand new valve in there. It's going to be a brand new valve, but gee whiz, do I really need a new aortic valve? Okay. Well, physicians would go to this number right here and say, well, your ejection fraction is 60%. That's normal. You don't need an aortic valve. Okay. So that would be, even though it's free, you probably don't want to do it, right? Okay. But if your ejection fraction is like 50 or 45%, okay, then the physician knows that your heart is failing, and if it's due to the aortic valve, you're going to say, well, a free aortic valve today is a really good option for me, okay? So they use this number to time surgery, so a patient can say, well, I'm not ready to go through that surgery because my ejection fraction really isn't that bad. But if you get this ejection fraction down to, say, 40% or 30%, then it's probably too late. So even though today you get that free valve, if your ejection fraction is 30%, your heart's not going to recover, Okay, so it's a really important number. It tells you when you're too late or as you're approaching that point in time when you have to have these procedures done on your heart. Okay. Frank Starling Law of the Heart. This is a pretty important concept. Let's look at this graph right here. It's a plot of stroke volume versus end diastolic volume of the heart. All right, so as we increase end diastolic volume, let's just look at one of these curves right here. As we increase end diastolic volume, what happens to stroke volume? And that's another way of thinking of the contractility, force of contraction on the heart. So as end diastolic volume increases, what happens to force of contraction on the heart? Okay, here I can see stroke volume is low at a low end diastolic volume. If we increase it, what happens to stroke volume? It increases. Okay, so that is the Frank Starling Law of the Heart. It just says as the ventricles start to stretch out, as the sarcomeres stretch, what happens to force of contraction that's being produced by the heart? It increases. That's a really handy feature because as we start to exercise and we get a lot of blood returning to the heart, if we get a lot of venous return, our heart is filling up, the heart is being presented with a lot of blood to pump, guess how the heart responds as we present the heart with a lot of blood to pump? How does the heart automatically respond? It gets stronger to pump that blood. So that's a really, really nice feature. Okay. The other graphs that we see on this curve right here, it just shows that if we increase sympathetic stimulation, that enhances the effect, that the heart gets stronger and stronger with increasing degrees of sympathetic stimulation. Okay, and so that's just controlled by your sympathetic nervous system. And remember, the parasympathetic nervous system doesn't go to the ventricle, so it can't affect these curves at all. So this effect, right, from one curve right here is what we call an intrinsic property of the heart or the myocardium. That's the Frank Starling Law. All right, when we use sympathetic stimulation to increase force of contraction, that's an extrinsic control on the heart because it's coming from outside the heart. So the heart is pretty marvelous because it has intrinsic control. As your body asks it to pump more blood because more blood is going to the heart responds by getting stronger. Okay, so as end diastolic volume increases, myocardium is stretched more, causing greater contraction and greater stroke volume. And the way that we conceptualize that is just think of a sarcomere. Okay, so here we have a sarcomere. You can see the thick filaments and filaments. And the end of a sarcomere are these Z-discs right over here. And how do these Z-discs get closer together? Does myosin get shorter? Does actin get shorter? No, they just slide over each other, right? So we see a nice sliding filament mechanism, even for cardiac muscle. All right, so I see four different cases right here, A through D, depending on what the overlap is or what the length is of a sarcomere before the sarcomere starts to contract. And it's plotted out tension versus time on the graph. And we can see in case number A right here that the Z lines are almost bunching up right up against the myosin filament. So even, and there's plenty of overlap between actin and myosin, so there are plenty of cross bridges that can form. But can myosin slide over actin anymore? There's no room, right? So this kind of sarcomere can only produce a very weak kind of contraction, even though, right, there's plenty of overlap, and that is signified by this A curve right here. Very little tension can be produced by this sarcomere because it's not stretched out. There's plenty of overlap, but there's no room for contraction anymore. And as we start to stretch the sarcomere out in condition B and C, what happens to force of contraction of that sarcomere? It increases as the sarcomere gets stretched out. Now let's relate that to the heart. As the sarcomere is getting stretched out, what's happening to the ventricle? It's filling with blood, right? The end diastolic volume is getting bigger. So the end diastolic volume is getting bigger and bigger in each of these conditions until we're in condition D right here, which is an optimal condition. We still have plenty of overlap between actin and myosin, so a large number of cross bridges can form. Right, and when cross bridges form, actin and myosin now can slide past each other, shortening the sarcomere, producing a lot of tension. So this is a nice way for you to visualize how end diastolic volume is directly related to stroke volume in terms of the Frank Starling Law of the Heart. All right. Let me go back to this figure right here. That's half of the law. Let me draw this other diagram just for fun on the board. So that's almost nice and dark. How about this marker right here? It's maybe a little bit darker. Okay, so what do we want to plot for Frank Starling law? We want to look at stroke volume or maybe contractility of the heart, either way. So I'll put stroke volume, or maybe I could say what? Inotropy of the heart or contractility, ventricular contractility. Those are all going to be the same thing. People talk about them the same way. Okay, and then down over here is going to be what? End diastolic volume, which is what? The same thing as the stretch of the ventricle. Okay, or filling of the ventricle at the end of diastole. And this is the Frank Starling law. So as the end diastolic volume increases, so we're going to go out in this direction, as end diastolic volume increases, what happens to contractility of the heart? Does it go down or go up? It goes up. Yeah, the heart gets stronger and kind of plateaus out. Okay, so this is what we call the ascending limb of the Frank Starling curve. All right, and then if we start to stretch the heart out even more, let's go to these sarcomeres. So let's stretch the sarcomere out even more. What's going to happen to force of contraction? And then we stretch it a little bit more. And then finally we stretch it out so much that there's no longer any overlap between actin and myosin. Let's look at that last condition. If there's no overlap between actin and myosin, can the filaments slide over each other? There's no cross bridges that can form. On that condition, that sarcomere can't produce any tension once again. All right, so if we keep stretching the heart out, guess what happens? It starts to get weaker and weaker and weaker and weaker as a result. Okay, so this is what we call the descending limb. And when somebody's heart is on the descending limb of the Frank Starling curve, then they're in heart failure. The heart is filling up with blood, okay, and it's getting weaker and weaker and weaker because the sarcomere is stretched out too much. Fortunately, if that's the only thing wrong with that person's heart, we can give them a miracle drug. And that will reverse the condition almost instantaneously. All right, it's going to take them from the descending limb of the Frank Starling curve back to over here. What happens to their heart function as we move from this location to this location over here? It gets stronger. It actually pulls them right out of heart failure. What can we give a person to decrease the stretch of their heart? Okay? And what you could do is give them a diuretic. So they'll take blood volume, fluid that's in their blood, their kidneys will take it out of their cardiovascular system, it'll end up in urine, pee it out of your body. So their blood volume decreases, so there's less volume of blood going back to the heart. What happens to the ventricle when there's less blood going back to it? The volume starts to decrease, and they just climb their way back up right out of heart failure. Okay, so under these conditions, for instance, okay, a diuretic could be given to bring them back to normal. Let's look at this ascending limb. Maybe somebody's in heart failure because they got into a really bad car accident and they had a hemorrhage, right? They lacerated a femoral artery or something and they lose a huge amount of blood volume on their way to the hospital. Okay, as they lose a lot of blood on the way to the hospital, what happens to their cardiac function? It starts to decrease just because blood is not flowing back to the heart and diastolic volume is shrinking. But on the way to the hospital, what can paramedics do? They can hook up an IV. They can hook up so that somebody has now saline being put into their cardiovascular system, their blood. So their blood volume expands, which means more blood goes back to the heart, even though it doesn't have red blood cells. But more blood volume goes back to the heart. So in this condition right here, if somebody has a hemorrhage, okay, if this is hemorrhage right here, then if we give transfusion, that increases their blood volume, that increases their end diastolic volume, and as a result, what happens to inotropy of their heart? It goes back up. Okay, so no drugs are necessary for that. That is just due to the intrinsic property of the heart. right? And that is what we call the Frank-Starling law. Okay, extrinsic control. That's due to the sympathetic nervous system. All right, so at any given end-diastolic volume, contraction depends on the level of sympathetic tone, which we call sympathetic tone in the body. And that could be due to release of epinephrine and norepinephrine from the adrenal medulla, or it could be due to axons releasing norepinephrine, sympathetic axons releasing norepinephrine on the myocardium itself, right? So that's extrinsic. So we just call that sympathoadrenal activity, or I call it sympathetic tone, right? So norepinephrine, epinephrine increase heart rate and force of contraction because the ventricle has adrenergic receptors. And an adrenergic receptor is something that binds what? Norepinephrine or epinephrine. Okay, and so when they bind epinephrine and norepinephrine, it will have a positive inotropic effect on the heart, which is what? Increases contractility of the heart because it's going to enhance the release of calcium, right, from the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And that's going to flood, you have more calcium within the sarcomeres as a result. So let's look at this graph right here. We have a plot of inotropy on the heart or relative tension versus muscle length. And because we know we have to look at the end-diastolic volume on the heart to understand anything about contractility. So here is the cardiac muscle without epinephrine. All right, so for instance, when it's at 80% stretch, it produces very little tension. It's not until you reach 90% or 100% of optimum that you get a lot of tension produced. But with positive inotropic agents like epinephrine and norepinephrine on the heart, notice that the heart starts to contract more strongly even before it starts to stretch out. So epinephrine has a positive inotropic effect on the heart. So this curve gets shifted to the left as you increase sympathetic tone or sympathoadrenal activity. The curve shifts to the left. Okay, and notice now, skeletal muscle right here, right, does not respond to epinephrine and norepinephrine. And that's because it doesn't have adrenergic receptors. Does anybody remember what kind of receptor skeletal muscle does have? Yeah, acetylcholine. Okay, and remember, is acetylcholine excitatory or inhibitory on skeletal muscle? It's excitatory, so that's kind of strange. How can acetylcholine be excitatory on skeletal muscle, but inhibitory on the SA node? Yeah, it has a different receptor, right? So the receptors in the SA node are muscarinic receptors, and receptors in skeletal muscle are nicotinic receptors, right? So it can be used in different ways. All right, so this right here is going to be an extra credit figure for you guys next week in lab. I want you to draw this out, and I'll email it to you just to make sure. All right, so the basis of this diagram, you already know that cardiac output is equal to heart rate. You could say cardiac rate times stroke volume, right? And we worked out the dimensions. Cardiac rate is what? Just beats per minute. Stroke volume is volumes per beat, which is what? A volume per time. So cardiac output is a volume per time. All right, so CO is a volume like mLs per minute. And that is what we call blood flow. That's a flow. So flow is volume per time of blood. What can influence heart rate? What structures in the heart influence heart rate or control heart rate? It is the pacemaker, which is the SA node and also the AV node that transmits signals into the ventricle. All right, and what nervous system goes to the SA node? The parasympathetic does for slowing the heart rate down. What about sympathetic? Yeah, it does for speeding the heart rate up. So both the parasympathetic and sympathetic nerves go to the SA node to adjust heart rate in a nice antagonistic fashion. All right, so this dotted line represents parasympathetic nerves. The solid lines represent sympathetic nerves. Now, where else do sympathetic nerves go? To the ventricles, okay? And they release norepinephrine That increases contraction strength, irregardless of what the end-diastolic volume is, or regardless of what the end-diastolic volume is. If you drop norepinephrine on a ventricle, the force of contraction is going to increase, and then, of course, what? Stroke volume is going to increase as well. All right, now what about parasympathetic stimulation on the contractile muscles? It doesn't go there. It only goes to the nodal tissues within the heart. So parasympathetic nervous system can have no effect on inotropy of the heart or contraction. All right, but we know some other things that affect contraction right here, and that is what? The Frank-Starling law of the heart. All right, as the heart starts to stretch because end-diastolic volume increases, the force of contraction increases, that increases the stroke volume right here. Okay, so that's a positive inotropic effect. And actually, this little limb over here kind of is related to stretch of the heart, right? Because if end-diastolic volume increases, the stretch increases, which increases contraction. So maybe this arrow I would have drawn in right over here. All right, mean arterial pressure, right, is going to decrease the stroke volume because the heart has to pump up against that pressure. That's what we call the afterload, right? So that is going to have a negative effect on cardiac output. All right, so, and that really doesn't have anything to do with the parasympathetic nervous system. So I got a feeling that, okay, cardiac output is going to be enhanced or increased with the solid lines and decreased with these dotted lines right here. Maybe that's a good way to think of it. Okay, as arterial pressure increases, cardiac output goes down. In the same sense that as we increase parasympathetic tone, cardiac output goes down because heart rate goes down. Okay, so I'll send you the diagram that I would like for you to draw in lab next week. Let's talk about another important parameter, and that is venous return. Okay, venous return is just return of blood to the heart via veins, right? It controls end-diastolic volume, and if it controls end-diastolic volume, it also has an effect on stroke volume. What would you use to explain the effect of end-diastolic volume on stroke volume, that they're directly related to each other in the normal heart? There's a law. That's called the Frank-Starling law of the heart. Okay, which says as the ventricle stretches, it just gets stronger. And as stroke volume increases, what happens to cardiac output? It increases because it's directly related. Okay, so venous return is dependent on blood volume and venous pressure. So venous return, let's look at this. If we take a bunch of blood out of somebody, or all of a sudden they damage a blood vessel and lose a lot of blood, okay, what happens to blood volume? It goes down. If there's less blood there, then there's less blood to return to the heart. So venous return is going to decrease as a result. Okay. If there is a vasoconstriction of veins, right, that's going to increase the pressure in veins, that's also going to increase venous return. All right, and that's due to sympathetic tone. So there are sympathetic nerve fibers that innervate veins that can cause them to vasoconstrict. All right, and that's going to help venous return. Skeletal muscle pumps. I think we talked about this. And that is whenever you have a vein and it gets compressed because skeletal muscles around it start to contract, that's going to pressurize blood in that segment of the vein, and it's going to squirt back to the heart, right? Because what's going to prevent blood in the vein from going away from the heart back to a peripheral region? Yeah, the valves, because veins have valves. All right, and then also, don't forget about the respiratory pump. Anytime there's a decrease in pressure in your thoracic cavity, not only is air going to rush into your thoracic cavity, but any kind of fluid will as well, including fluid in veins, will be sucked up into the thoracic cavity. And where is your heart located? In your thoracic cavity. So that returns blood to the heart directly. So here we have end-diastolic volume is determined by venous return. Right, so that is determined by breathing, the respiratory pump, the blood volume, and blood volume is going to be regulated by how much urine a person is producing. As you produce a lot of urine, then blood volume is going to decrease. If you're well hydrated, if you drink a lot of fluids during the day, what happens to blood volume? it increases, okay, which means that you're going to have more venous return, which means then you'll have better cardiac function as a result of that. Okay, the same thing for tissue fluid volume. Okay, for instance, maybe one way to increase tissue fluid would be by eating a lot of salt. You'll retain a lot of water. You won't be producing very much urine. Okay, that will increase blood volume. That will increase venous return, and that will increase end-diastolic volume. We talked about breathing already. Venous pressure right here could be adjusted by exercise, right, skeletal muscle pump, but also by sympathetic stimulation of smooth muscle around veins. Veins can constrict, and when they constrict, they pressurize, which then pushes blood up to the heart as long as the valves within veins are functioning. And if valves in veins aren't functioning, then the blood will be pushed back down to extremities. All right, so this shows you the importance of venous return on controlling heart function, which is determined by blood volume. That's probably the most important thing. Second most important thing would be venous pressure due to sympathetic stimulation of venoconstriction. And probably the third thing of importance would be the negative intrathoracic pressure. All right, so we're not done talking about veins yet. So here we have a graph that shows the percentage of blood, okay, and where in the body it's located. All right, so we see some 10% we find in lungs, only 8% to 10% in the heart. There's a fair amount in arteries, maybe 10%, very little in capillaries, right? And the rest of the blood volume right here, which is about 70%, is in veins, right? So changing this volume right here by vasoconstriction can actually pump a lot of blood to the heart, right? Increasing end-diastolic volume. All right, and so very small changes in pressure of these veins right here can cause a large change in the volume of these vessels. And that's what we call compliance or capacitance of a blood vessel. So what's another good way of thinking about compliance or capacitance? The definition is, if there is a vessel that's highly compliant or has a lot of capacitance, it means that it can change its shape, it can change its volume drastically with small changes in pressure. All right, vessels that have very little capacitance, in order to change their shape, there has to be a big change in pressure for them to change shape. All right, so let's compare a tire on your car and a balloon. Which one is more compliant? Okay, and I can't remember if I went over this with you already. Good. Okay, so a balloon is a lot more compliant because very little pressure changes, right, can change, make a big change in volume of a balloon compared to the tire on your car. All right, and veins only have about 0 to about 10 millimeters of mercury pressure in them, which is a very small force to get this blood to return back to the heart. Okay. All right, so let's talk about body volumes, blood volumes, because that greatly influences heart function via the Frank-Starling law. All right, so blood volume and thus blood pressure is controlled by three hormones in your body. One is called antidiuretic hormone, another is aldosterone, and a third is atrial natriuretic hormone. And natri right here, in this term, natriuretic hormone, comes from how we name an element on the periodic table, okay? And natrium stands for sodium, right? So it has to do with regulation of sodium. And what part of the body does this come from? What secretes atrial natriuretic hormone? The atria on the heart. So the heart is an endocrine organ. We don't really recognize it generally, but it is. Okay, because it secretes atrial natriuretic hormone. All right, so here's a good question that eventually I want you to answer. Which of the above hormones are synergistic and which are antagonistic to each other? Would you expect to have any antagonistic control? Yeah, because that's what provides precise control and balance of blood pressure, is to have nice antagonistic control. All right, which was kind of strange. What did we see about the heart? Let's go back to this diagram right over here. We saw antagonistic control in terms of heart rate, But what about antagonistic control in terms of stroke volume or the inotropy on the heart? There is an antagonistic control, which is really, really strange. All right, so the force of the heart, right, will influence your blood pressure. Now, do you know anybody that has problems with their blood pressure, and in what sense? Is it too high or too low usually? Yeah, hypertension is very prevalent, okay? Probably one of the reasons why is because there's not antagonistic control of your heart, of your stroke volume, because you only have the sympathetic nervous system going there. That's kind of like a design flaw, in my opinion. You have nice antagonistic control of heart rate, but not in terms of stroke volume. Okay, so partly making up for that are these hormones right here, but they can't do their job, okay, completely. So let's take a look at antidiuretic hormone. It has another name, and you should probably write this out like 10 times. People use these names interchangeably in the same sentence, and it can be very confusing. Antidiuretic hormone and vasopressin are exactly the same thing. Antidiuretic hormone, you should have a sense for. What does a diuretic do? Yeah, it makes you pee. It makes you lose volume, fluid volume from your body. And as you produce urine, you lose blood volume. So it decreases blood volume. Antidiuretic hormone does what? The opposite, right? It preserves fluid inside your body. It prevents the formation of urine. So as urine formation is prevented or is reduced, what happens to blood volume? It increases, okay? That blood volume goes back to the heart, okay? That increases the strength of contraction of the heart. Okay, vasopressin, ADH was also called vasopressin because not only does it have an effect on the kidneys, which then increases function of the heart, it has a direct effect on blood vessels, and it causes blood vessels to constrict. And what happens to blood pressure when blood vessels constrict? A nice simple way of thinking about it is, if you have a balloon and you squeeze down on a balloon, what happens to pressure in that balloon? It increases, right? So vasoconstriction increases blood pressure. So both of these effects of this hormone increase blood pressure. If you increase blood volume, that increases blood pressure. And if you vasoconstrict, that increases blood pressure. So that's a really nice effect of this hormone. It helps to maintain blood pressure, okay, by increasing it. All right, so ADH, remember, is released by the posterior pituitary, not the anterior, okay, when there are osmoreceptors in the hypothalamus, when they detect high salt. And these osmoreceptors are in the hypothalamus, all right, and you have high salt when you have excess intake, okay, and when would you have excess intake of salt? Eating a lot of potato chips, drinking too many margaritas. Yeah, we do it all the time. In the American diet, it's impossible not to have excess salt in your diet. Okay, all right, or dehydration when we don't drink proper fluids. Okay, so these osmoreceptors then can trigger the thirst center, which is also right inside the hypothalamus, right, which causes then, if you're thirsty, how do you respond to that? By drinking, okay, so that increases blood volume. And ADH then also stimulates water resorption from urine. So urine is the product that you're going to excrete from your body. That's going to be lost. When we say resorption, water is taken from that product that's going to be lost from your body and does what? It puts it back into your blood, right? So when we say resorption, that means it's put back into your body. We talked about that a little bit in anatomy, but we'll talk about it more in physiology. All right, ADH release is inhibited by low osmolality. That is when what? When you're high in water, right? So let's take a look at this diagram right here. First, let's start with the stimulus. Low blood volume, like what happens during dehydration, or salt ingestion. Blood osmolality increases. It becomes what? More salty. Right? The osmoreceptors in the hypothalamus then respond because it has a set point. That's the integration center. And then it makes a decision on what to do. It stimulates the thirst center in the hypothalamus, which then causes drinking. So you take a lot of fluid into your body, that increases blood volume, that decreases blood osmolality. All right, and blood osmolality, this is the response. How does that correspond to the initial stimulus? It subtracts from it, so that's a nice negative feedback mechanism. Okay? But we also have the posterior pituitary, right? The hypothalamus sends action potentials down into the posterior pituitary. Those axons release antidiuretic hormone. Antidiuretic hormone is picked up by the cardiovascular system, right? Because it's a hormone, goes to the kidneys, and it slows the production of urine by causing an increased resorption of water. So water retention by the kidneys that stays in your body, so that increases blood volume. And once again, that decreases blood osmolality, which is what? Subtracts from the stimulus right here. So here's a nice negative feedback loop. So as you increase blood volume right here, ADH has a tendency to maintain blood pressure, to keep it high. So you might be thinking about all those people with hypertension. Oh, here's a possible mechanism. Maybe that's not operating properly in some people. All right, so remember, ADH and vasopressin are the same thing. Let's go to the next hormone, aldosterone. Oh, but on this slide, on the previous slide, what's the effect of ADH on blood pressure? So say BP, put an up arrow or a down arrow. Okay? And if your blood volume is increasing, okay, like if you have that balloon once again, and you blow air into the balloon, what happens to pressure inside the balloon? Does it go up or down? Okay? It increases. So ADH will increase blood pressure because it's filling your blood system up with fluid, with volume. That will increase blood pressure. Okay, aldosterone, steroid hormone, and it's secreted by the, oh, this is just a simple blast from the past. Who knows? Okay, I don't know if I want to say medulla. I want to say adrenal gland, and it's the cortex, right? Aldosterone. And remember, that's a steroid hormone, so it's a hydrophobic hormone. We'll look at that somewhere later on in the class. All right, helps maintain blood volume. If it helps maintain blood volume, what's the effect on blood pressure? It helps maintain high blood pressure, and pressure through reabsorption and retention of salt and water from urine. So with low aldosterone, you'll be producing, okay, a lot of salty urine as a result. So you'll be losing blood volume. All right, so aldosterone secretion is stimulated by salt deprivation, because when you're salt deprived, aldosterone is going to be secreted so that you resorb a lot of sodium from urine and it's put back in your body to bring it back up to the normal level. Low blood volume, aldosterone will be secreted because aldosterone will cause the resorption, right, of water from urine. So water will be put back into your body as a result, won't be lost as urine. And as blood volume increases, what happens to blood pressure? It increases. So low blood pressure is a stimulus for the secretion of aldosterone. Right? So it works in a nice negative feedback mechanism. So put BP once again on this slide with either an up arrow or a down arrow. It's going to be up. What was this previous slide? What was BP over here? Up arrow or down arrow for BP? Up. So what can you tell me about the effects of ADH and aldosterone on blood pressure? Are they synergistic or antagonistic? They're synergistic, right? Okay. And which way is blood going, blood pressure going? In the dangerous direction. It's going up. Okay. All right, so here is, oh, really important. This might be one of the most important parts of the class. All right, here is the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism we're going to talk about. All right, when there is a salt deficit, low blood volume or low blood pressure, there is something called angiotensin II that's produced in the body. Angiotensin II causes a number of effects, all aimed at increasing blood pressure. Angiotensin II will cause vasoconstriction, which increases blood pressure, right? Increases aldosterone secretion. And what kind of arrow did we put for aldosterone on the previous slide? Increases blood pressure. And thirst, when you're thirsty, what do? You relieve that thirst by drinking. That increases blood volume. As blood volume increases, what happens to blood pressure? It increases as well. Okay. All right, so that's kind of some of the bullet points for the aldosterone mechanism, the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. But here it is on this slide. This is an exam figure, not for the exam on Tuesday, however, but on your last exam. So let's take a look at this.
could be the most important figure in your in the class. So we're that Wiggers diagram is pretty important too. I don't want to understate that. Okay, so the stimulus that triggers the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism is a decrease in blood pressure or a decrease in blood flow to the kidneys. All right, but you can imagine if there's decreased blood pressure, then there's going to be decreased blood flow to kidneys. Okay, so these are almost synonymous. There's a part of the kidney then called the juxtaglomerular apparatus that can sense this decrease in pressure and blood flow, and it's going to secrete renin. Renin is an enzyme, and it's spelled just with one N, into the blood. So renin then works on something called angiotensinogen. This is in your blood all the time. And what can you tell me about angiotensinogen? It's a precursor because you see ogen right here. All right, let's also dissect and analyze this word a little bit. Angio right here, does anybody know what the root of angio means? It means vessel. Vessel. Angio is a vessel. Angioplasty is some kind of surgical technique on a blood vessel. What about angio? Anybody a botanist in here? There are angiosperms. These are plants that make seeds in a vessel, like a seed pod. Okay, so angio just means like a blood vessel. Tensin means what? Puts tension on a blood vessel, like when blood pressure increases. So this has to do with increasing tension in a blood vessel, and it's a precursor, and it's inactive, but it can be converted into a more active form by renin, which comes from the kidneys right here. Okay, as a matter of fact, the juxtaglomerular apparatus. So angiotensinogen in the blood gets converted into angiotensin 1. It's floating around. Angiotensin 1 has some effects on the body, right? But the most powerful form of angiotensin is angiotensin 2. Angiotensin 1 has to be converted into angiotensin 2 by an enzyme called angiotensin converting enzyme, or ACE. Some of you might be familiar with some of these terms already. Okay, so ACE, we just say ACE. And ACE is found, okay, in the liver, there might be some in the liver, but mostly in the lungs. It's a strange place for it, but it's in the lungs. All right, so angiotensin 1 gets converted to 2 in the lungs. Angiotensin 2 is still a hormone, and it travels everywhere in the blood. And then it's going to go to the adrenal cortex. Angiotensin 2 causes the adrenal cortex to release aldosterone that we just talked about. And what did aldosterone do? It helps retain salt and water in the body. Right, so aldosterone retains salt and water in the body. We call that what? It increases resorption from the kidney tubules. Right, and as you increase salt and water, they kind of work together. As you increase salt, then water is going to move by diffusion from the kidneys back into the circulatory system. That increases blood volume. All right, and if we increase blood volume, what happens to blood pressure? It increases. All right, so the initial stimulus was a decrease in blood volume, but aldosterone increases blood volume, so that's a nice negative feedback mechanism. And that by itself will increase blood pressure, which was one of the initial stimuli. Angiotensin 2 by itself will cause vasoconstriction of arterioles, which increases blood pressure, right? Which then feeds back to the initial stimulus in a negative way, so that's another nice negative feedback mechanism. So this is a way that your body adjusts blood pressure in your body. This is the most important mechanism for regulating blood pressure in the long term. There are two ways that you can regulate blood pressure. One is short term and one is long term. And this long term mechanism relies on hormones. The short term mechanism relies on something that is very short lived in your body, and that is through your nervous system, right? Nervous system is fast acting but short duration. Endocrine system is slower to act but it's a much longer duration. So here we see an endocrine mechanism. It's short acting but it can act for a much longer period of time. So if somebody is suffering from hypertension, which is high blood pressure, then this mechanism right here is not working for them properly in the long term. All right, so this is the most important mechanism for long-term regulation of blood pressure. And if anybody spent any time in a clinical setting, you just know how important hypertension is. It's a very prevalent disease, and it's a killer. It will kill your heart and kidneys and everything else. So you got to help people be compliant. So how can this mechanism be manipulated to reduce somebody's blood pressure? So let's take a look at some of these things. Hypertension can be managed by a number of things. The first line of treatment would be a diuretic. Okay, because what does a diuretic do? It decreases blood volume. That will reduce somebody's blood pressure. All right, but this mechanism might take over and say, oh, your blood pressure is decreasing. I better secrete more renin, which then causes more secretion of aldosterone. So even though you're on a diuretic, your body might compensate and secrete more aldosterone, which will do what to your blood pressure? It will bring it back up to whatever that set point is, even though it's not an appropriate set point. Okay, so in most cases, it's rare for somebody with hypertension to get away with just one drug. Usually they have to take a number of pharmaceutical agents to help them with their hypertension. Okay, so here we have that angiotensin-converting enzyme, ACE, which converts angiotensin 1 to angiotensin 2. Remember, an angiotensin 2 causes the release of aldosterone, which increases blood pressure by increasing blood volume. Well, somebody developed some ACE inhibitors, right? So an ACE inhibitor blocks the production of angiotensin 2, which then blocks the secretion of aldosterone, which then brings blood volume down, which brings blood pressure down. So that's a second line that somebody could some other drug somebody could take to alleviate hypertension, are ACE inhibitors, all right? And then there are ARBs. Angiotensin 2 receptor blockers, because remember, angiotensin 2 is a hormone. In order to have an effect on the adrenal cortex, okay, how can angiotensin 2 have an effect on the adrenal cortex? Because the adrenal cortex is a target tissue, and a target tissue has a receptor for it, right? And if we block that receptor, then you can elevate angiotensin 2 levels, and then angiotensin 2 can't have an effect on the adrenal cortex if those receptors are blocked. So angiotensin 2 receptor blockers is a third way to help somebody control hypertension. All right, another line would be beta blockers. Okay, and what do you know about beta blockers? Beta right here refers to another kind of receptor, not an angiotensin receptor, but an adrenergic receptor for norepinephrine. Okay, and what places in your body have beta receptors for norepinephrine? I could give you one example. Yeah, your heart. Okay, and when a beta receptor on the heart is stimulated, what happens to heart rate? It increases. What happens to force of contraction? It increases. Both of those effects will increase blood pressure. So if we block those receptors on the heart slows down, the force of contraction goes down. What happens to blood pressure as a result? It goes down as well. Okay. So that's another line that somebody could take. Another one is calcium channel blockers, because in order for myosin and actin within the heart to slide over each other, what has to be there? Calcium has to go through calcium channels, and there are specific calcium channel blockers for the heart that somebody could take to decrease the amount of calcium in the sarcomeres of the myocardium. That will also decrease inotropy of the heart, decreasing blood pressure. Okay, and then here is another adrenergic receptor, which we didn't talk about very much. Okay, these alpha-2 receptors, they're not on the heart, at least as far as I know, but these are inside the central nervous system. These are central receptors, and they can be stimulated with a compound called clonidine, and they're very powerful regulators of blood pressure. Okay, and so if somebody has such high blood pressure where a physician is concerned that they might have an aneurysm any second, right, because their blood pressure, what's a normal blood pressure, did we say? Like 120 over 80. But if somebody's blood pressure is 200 over 100, right, they could blow up a blood vessel at any second. So then clonidine would be used to reduce their blood pressure drastically and immediately. Okay. But not many people can tolerate it, so usually don't use it for the long term. But in emergency situations, you can. And some people can use it long term, but just not very many people, because it makes you feel so bad, usually. Okay? As do all of these things right here. Most of these things, when a patient is treated for hypertension, when they get to normal tension, okay, they don't feel right. They feel very lethargic. And so there's a lot of psychological, negative psychological effects of using these things. So there's a tendency to be non-compliant and not to take these pharmaceuticals. And then what happens to the patient's blood pressure? It goes up, and then they feel normal, and they think, oh, thank goodness, I feel normal. And if you don't check your blood pressure, then you see what? Unfortunately, you're slowly killing yourself. So using this mechanism right here is really important, and helping patients stay compliant or family members is really important. And remember, you might have to take one, not just one, but two, maybe three different kinds of medications. And guess what? You can't get that all figured out overnight. It might take 6 months or a year for somebody to take the right kinds of medication to where their blood pressure is normal, plus also feel normal at the same time. All right, so it's kind of a long process. All right, so this is a really important mechanism. Okay, and then next time after the test, we'll talk about this last hormone right here. So put a BP on this slide with a question mark and take a guess. What arrow is going to be where that question mark is going to be? The first two were up, right? ADH was up, aldosterone was up, atrial natriuretic hormone should be antagonistic to those first two, right? Okay, so we're going to talk about this next time. And the sign-in sheet was going around somewhere. So a week from today. We're going to finish this chapter up a week from today, yeah. Yes.
There's only going to be one figure from chapter 14 on the test.
Oh, I don't think, is this chapter 14 that I was just talking about? I don't think there's any figure from 14 on the test.
Oh, okay.
It's just going to be 12 and 13.
Oh.
And the Wiggers diagram from the lab manual, which is the blood pressure, blood volume, ECG, and heart sounds from your lab manual. So that particular figure is not in 12, 13, or 14. Okay? You have a figure that's similar to it in chapter 13. But the one in your lab manual is much better. Yeah, it's much better. Yeah.
Thank you.
Hi.